The following is this week's recording of our live streams, which take place on Discord. We call these meetings kinship because we realize that the deepest mutuality is not one of biography or biology, but one of ideas. And this is a time for us to discuss the most edifying ideas that come to mind. You can join the Discord community to meet and interact with like-minded people via the link in the description. I hope you will enjoy the following discussions.
So the question was, you discussed, I think we discussed in this meeting or in general also about the ups and downs due to the pain and pleasure that we experience, right? And we were discussing how peace is on a completely different plane, right? Now, this whole channel is based on the idea that, philosophy is a way of life and not a theoretical understanding of it. Understanding that such pain, pleasure exists, and there's a sinusoidal wave, and, all that thing is interesting, very interesting. But when you come to apply that, it seems like you can't quite really escape it. And I was thinking about it, that even if I'm peaceful, I still experience pain, I still experience pleasure. So it's not like you ever get out of it, or I don't think that's the objective, I guess, but I'm not sure. So what's the objective? Why do we learn about this idea that, this pain, pleasure thing exists when we can't do anything about it, basically? And this different plane, which we can't be on all the time, the peace plane that we talked about, I took it that way. Maybe that was not the intention to put it that way. My education always, comes in the way. It always, I process it through that. So I come back and think about XYZ planes and, XY plane something and Z plane, there's something else. And it sometimes comes in the way of my understanding. Maybe you were or others were saying something different, and I took it in a different manner. But anyways, the question is, how do you come to sort of get away from this, if at all? If not, what is the, why do we understand that such two things exist when we can't do anything about it?
When you say escape it and that you can't do anything about it, what are you referring to?
The pain pleasure cycle, I guess. The pain pleasure cycle.
And what does the pain pleasure cycle have to do with peace?
I think the two are mutually exclusive to each other.
So you think when someone experiences pain, they are unable to have peace?
Yeah, sure.
How is that? Because all those people who, for example, experience joy, like you mentioned, joy can be anything, right? We can experience joy from eating, from drinking, from bodily pleasures in general. And we can experience joy from sort of material goods, also like outside of the body, but still material, still earthly, right? Such as money, wealth, resources. And that can be a joy. Now, whether it's lasting or not, whether it's the deepest joy or not, that's a separate question. But it's certainly we can experience joy in that way. However, I don't think it would be right to say that anyone who is currently enjoying a good meal, anyone whose material circumstances are in the process of improving, we can't say that they have peace necessarily, right?
Okay.
And vice versa, people who have peace are not necessarily people who get to eat right now, are not necessarily people whose wealth is increasing or even at a point that is sufficient for them to conduct their daily profane earthly material lives.
Right.
So I would just put the question out there if we should confuse happiness and peace, if it's really the same thing, or if happiness is actually the pain joy cycle that you're talking about and peace is something else. Peace is the absence of everything that disrupts peace. Not everything that disrupts happiness, everything that disrupts peace. For example, one can have the biggest material advantages in the world, the most abundance, the most of whatever people might say brings happiness.
Right.
But they might still, and in fact most people do, have resentment towards anything that happened in their past. They might say, yes, I've made myself the successful, strong, wealthy person, fill in the blanks, whatever you want to say. And I've showed those people in the past who never believed in me, who always tried to keep me down, I showed them that I am strong. But nevertheless, we think of this past with resentment. We think of these people with dismissal, with hatred. Every time we think of them, literally our peace is disturbed. We remember unpleasant memories. We still think about those couple of people who, despite our success, are still disparaging us, are still not recognizing our success, at least not fully. And so we still carry that resentment, for example. Now, this person cannot be said to have peace.
Okay. So
yeah.
I had a few things when you were saying that came up. One was I believe the way you define peace, wasn't it a bit circular in a way? Peace is everything that peace is not, which is I guess understood, but that doesn't offer me an understanding of, you know, what I don't know. I still don't get it. Maybe if you can elaborate on that, that's one. And two it is a narrative. It's something that we hear often, that people who are in pain can have peace. People who have peace may not necessarily have material things. I feel we talk very little about people who have material things and have peace. I don't know if that is even possible. So is it a bad thing to have material things? Because say, for example, one is situated such that they have those things, you know, and life is working out, at least in the materialistic sense, it's working out well for them. Of course, you know, they were born in privilege and that's what's going on. And we talk very little about having those materialistic things and having peace. So I don't know, is that a thing? Because peace seems to be against consumption or too much of anything. But when someone has too much of anything, does it necessarily imply that they cannot have peace? Those came up when you were speaking.
Yeah, but like I said, happiness is determined by things that are outside of your control. This is another way of thinking about it. And peace is determined by everything that is in your control and, in fact, is only in your control. For example, there's no material circumstance, there's no pain or pleasure that you can experience that will automatically have you let go of past resentments or a general state of worrying, general state of hanging on to the past, constantly thinking about the future, things like this. There's nothing that can happen to you that can free you from that. That is something internal. And vice versa, anyone who has freed themselves from that has peace regardless of what is going on outside. They might not be able to be happy right now because they're experiencing pain, like you said. But peace and happiness are two separate things. I want you to be able to see that. Right? Peace is a state of being. Happiness is just something that happens to you or does not happen to you. But peace is a constant state of being that cannot be affected to a large degree by external happenings, but by the pain and joy cycle, so to speak, as you said, that is happening. That affects happiness, not peace. And so, yes, a person who has a lot of material things, if they're not peaceful, their happiness will be disturbed by that too. It will be too much for them because they don't have the capabilities of dealing with that, of dealing with abundance, which brings its own challenges and its own disadvantages because they've never found peace. So they're still in turmoil. It does not matter if the turmoil is caused by external so-called bad things or external so-called good things. The turmoil is inside of you. If it wasn't inside of you, nothing could provoke it from the outside because there's nothing to provoke. And so peace is something that's up to you, just like, and peace comes through what is commonly referred to as the virtues. And happiness is just what randomly happens to you materialistically outside in the physical world. But neither good nor bad of that can penetrate deep inside the true you, which is a state of being, your existence, your very core being, which inherently is not physical. It's not a material existence. So nothing material can touch it, right? But happiness, like I said, is very much determined by those externals. So we always say happiness is one thing and peace is another. Or happiness is one thing, virtue is another. Does that make more sense?
Interesting. So one question, again, that came up, again, it's something that you love to ask. May I just ask you back now? So let's say I'm happy because I had a good meal. So I'm happy because I, you know, bodily pleasure, and that I can describe it to some part of me, right? But so this is the question you often ask. If I am at peace, who is at peace?
Is that your question?
I mean, if I am at peace, who is at peace? I mean, if we have for our conversation established the fact that, you know, if we are trying to attempt to understand who we are, let's just stick to the fact that, you know, at best that we can, you know, attack it is that we are awareness. And if we are at peace, the question is, if we are at peace, then who is at peace? Because awareness, shouldn't be... shouldn't be in turmoil anyways. I mean, I don't know.
And it isn't. So, and it
the question
isn't.
I had.
Yeah, awareness isn't turmoil. It is always in peace. But is all those things that we add to it, which we call, you could call the identities, the ego, those are the things that we attach to or that we attach ourselves to, and we think we are those things. And those are the things that push and pull us and drag us in and out of so-called happiness. And then we think that is the highest good, right? And the deep, constant state that is up and away from happiness, from the roller coaster, from the cycle, is easily missed. You know, we keep chasing because it felt so good. And now that right. It's absent, it feels so bad. We keep chasing that thing that felt so good. And we never extend our vision past that roller coaster of up and down. We never extend our vision to see that constant state of peace that is behind it all. Right? And that's why all the religions, all the philosophers, everyone tells us to annihilate ourselves, to destroy ourselves, because what we think is the self is actually the ego. So when you destroy the ego, you're not actually destroying yourself. It's just what you've been calling the self all this time that you're destroying. And once you do so, you realize that not only do you still exist, in fact, for the first time, you truly exist, because for the first time, you truly know what you are by knowing who you are not. And when you finally get there, that's when you get to experience peace. It was always there, but you were choosing to hang on to this roller coaster that constantly keeps going up and down and up and down. If you would have let go before, you would have had peace before, but it was always there and it always will be there.
Yeah, and it's not like, you know, we have not experienced it. I mean, everybody has experienced it. And that's why when we talk of peace, everyone knows what you're talking about. But it's just a very flimsy thing, far away. Like, it happens, you know, very momentarily, for an hour when we get up, like, early on. Like, you know, the alarm was set for 5 a.m., but I got up at 4 a.m. Because I slept a little early. And, you know, it feels good, I guess. I don't know if that's what is meant by peace. I don't know. But it, I don't know, but somebody, for some reason, everybody knows what peace is, even though we have kind of come to conclude, at least I came to conclude, that I can't quite get there. It's not that something I can, you know, have all the time, but let's make peace with that and you know, go do our business, basically.
Well, and with that attitude, how could you possibly have peace? If you are saying that peace is something that you cannot have, then of course you will never have it because you've decided not to have it. But truth does not change depending on our opinion. Truth is that peace is something that was there before you and it will be there after you. And you can partake in it if you want to, if you truly want to, and won't if you won't. And so that's why we call it the work of life. The work of life is to let go of everything that is on top of your peace that is obscuring it. And one of those things is the idea that you cannot have peace. One of those things are that you need to let go of is the idea that you cannot have peace. Just because it keeps being obscured doesn't mean it's not there. And every time, you know, you call it fragile, but it's not fragile. Your vision of it is fragile. Peace is not fragile. Peace is what every single thing rests on. Our vision of it is fragile. And you hear it all the time, you know, the identities talked about as sometimes as veils. So many people use that analogy or that metaphor and said you need to take down all the veils that you have in between you and yourself, the true you, or in between you and peace, however you want to put it. And so that's the work of life, to let go of that. And one of the illusions is that if it hasn't happened by now, it won't happen ever. That's just another wrong idea that we all have. And so that's another thing to let go of. Just because you're not seeing all of the veils, or you get to see peace sometimes and not other times, that doesn't say anything about peace whatsoever. Peace is truly at rest.
You know? So I just wanted to talk about... The fact that I know about peace and all this idea was, so there was a couple of years ago, what happened was there was a really good friend of mine, and he passed away due to an accident. And he was really into this work of life. He really was somebody who gave me inspiration. Like, I didn't knew this channel, but, you know, he was religious. He was very, but he did this work in a way. And, you know, it was really nice talking to him. And when he passed away due to an accident, for a couple of days, it just it felt different, the world and things, and then you know, all those little things, you know, I was having some feud with somebody or whatever, you know, little whatever was going on didn't matter as much. It just didn't. And then I kind of knew, okay, this is probably what we call peace. I cannot explain it, but it's more like it went on for a week, 5-7 days or so. And it was great. But obviously, things came in the way, fears came in the way. I had lots of other things came up. But that was when I really knew that, okay, this is something that exists. And so I had a taste of it. And that's why I knew, okay, this is something that exists. And it's not supposed to be fragile, or it's not supposed to be this fragile. Or it can at least sustain for a week. That was a big deal. It's, you know, an experience that I don't forget.
Yeah, that was your glimpse of it. Your vision of it,
yeah.
Is fragile. Can be, rather. I'm not saying it is or it isn't. It is whatever you say it is, but you're the one experiencing it. But our vision of it is what can be fragile, not peace itself. And you said, you know, it was a great week, but then fear came back in and all that. And yeah, you cannot hold on to fear and have peace. But it is you who's holding on to fear. Fear itself is not an actual being. It's an illusion, right? We talk about that all the time. Whenever we're afraid of something, it happens so many times, whenever we're afraid of something and for whatever reason we do it anyway, either just because we have to, and we see that it was possible, I just did it. So what was I afraid about this whole time, right? And that's fear in every single situation. It's not that it is sometimes an illusion and sometimes it's real. It is always an illusion. And the illusion is that sometimes it is real. And so we never know, is this the time that it's real? But once we understand, no, that's the very nature of fear, that it tells us that any which fear could be the real one. And so every single new fear seems like an entirely different thing, but every single time it is the same illusion, it is the same trick. It's just fear is really good at seeming real. Otherwise, who would ever have fear if it wasn't good at that?
Yeah.
Right? So it is your work. Again, another way of talking about the work of life. It is your work to let go of everything that stands between you and peace. And every single thing that can stand between you and peace is something that you can remove. And in fact, only you can remove. The entire world could tell you that what some fear of yours is an illusion. If you don't believe it, it's not going to happen. It's going to remain, right? Vice versa, the whole world could tell you it's real. If you know it's an illusion, you could not even bring yourself to think it's real, even if you wanted to. And so that work is entirely yours. Entirely. And this is not something to despise. This is a privilege. What a privilege it is to be able to have the right to, and not only the right, the full capability to remove every single thing that stands between you and peace. And also the realization that peace is probably not what you thought it was, you know, because we've been taught wrong, not intentionally, but we've been taught wrong about pretty much everything. A lot of people will think peace is happiness. Again, they'll confuse that. But there are so many examples of people physically suffering or doing something that goes entirely against their own survival instinct or everything they've ever known for a greater purpose. And that greater purpose, even to attempt that, is peace. Because they are of truth, right? They know what is right, and they pursue that no matter what. And to pursue truth no matter what is also something that gets you closer to peace, or is peace itself in many circumstances. So you see all these people who are suffering or who are doing things that are the last things that you'd ever want to do. But for some reason, they're doing them. Why is that? Why would they do that? If peace was to be away from agony, away from pain, away from distress, away from all those things, away from hunger, away from pleasures, then why would anyone do it? It's because peace is not happiness. That's a different thing. Happiness is nothing in comparison to death. Clearly, otherwise people wouldn't pursue it. People who are truly at peace, people who truly know what truth is, they would not pursue those things that are that clearly go against happiness. Right? So just think about that. And another illusion, there are so many illusions, so many lies that the ego tells you, that your identities tell you. But one of them is that you need to figure this out as soon as possible. And that as long as you haven't figured it all out, you're wasting your life. And you don't know what you're doing. And you're worthless and you're incomplete. And it looks like you're never going to figure it out. So the stress of that, the anxiety, all of that are illusions to keep you away from peace, because all your identities, the ego, whatever you want to call it, it does not matter, needs drama. It needs to fight against something, because it cannot be at peace. It cannot stand the state of being in which you just sit and everything is fine. And there are no problems and there are no enemies and there's nothing wrong and there's nothing left to prove and there's nothing left to disprove and all that. It cannot sit in that. It will go mad. All right. So it's trying to make you see problems, have you have fears, anxieties, worries, regrets, shame, guilt, all these things that keep you from peace, right? All these things are things that stand in between you and peace. And when I say you, I mean everyone. And so to remove each and every single thing that stands between you, which is an illusion, which is a lie, which is not you, which comes from the not you, the false self, which comes from identities, which you have attached yourself to, but which you are not, all those things, it is on you to remove. And like I said, at the same time, it is your privilege to remove those things. Only humans can be in peace in that way. It's a human privilege. So it's not just your work, it's your privilege. You are uniquely able to reside in that state.
Yeah. It's a very interesting observation I've had, even on the chat that, you know, I'm partaking every now and then, that, you know, we have these questions and they trail around and things happen, go all over the place. But if, to me, the way I see it, they all come back to the same thing, you know, getting back and removing, you know, the best way to put it is removing all that is not me from me. It seems to me that many questions do converge. Too many questions do converge to just that, like this one, I guess.
Yes. Say that again. Was there a question there? I missed that. Sorry.
No, there was no question. It was just a statement.
Yeah. So why don't you just keep your focus on that? Why think about anything else? Why listen to anything else? You have seen peace before. You know it's real. You know it's there, and you know it's something that's always there. It's independent of you. It was there before you. It will be there after you. It asks nothing of you, and it needs nothing of you, but you can partake in it. You know all of that. What else do you need to know? What else can you be given? What else can you be shown? This is it. You know exactly what to do. It's only the doing that's left. And the doing, no one can do for you. No one should be able to do it. It's your privilege. Once you see that your own actions that you are 100% in control, and that as soon as you will it, you can have it. And it's only the things that stand between you and your will that prevent you from having it. It's we just talked about joy. It is the greatest joy to be able to realize that. It is the greatest joy to see how powerless you are in all the unimportant things and how powerful you are in the most important things and the most beautiful things. And we keep chasing the best things in the realm of the physical, in the realm of chance, in the realm of luck, in the realm of pain and joy, in the realm of sadness and euphoria. And we never think of that greatest realm which everything else rests on, and which was there before everything physical and thereafter everything physical, a continuous, undisturbable state of being that is called peace. I mean, it's really literally a great analogy to think about money. Think about the time span that money has existed in, not only in human existence, but in the existence of the universe. Compare that to the time span that money has existed in. It is literally almost nothing in comparison. It's so small, right? Even in human history, it's so small. And human history, in comparison to the planet's history, is so small. And the planet's history, in comparison to the universe's history, is so small. Yet, people, so many people, millions, if not billions of people, put money first above all else. And that sort of tells you everything that you need to know, right? How misguided we are. So drop it.
Right.
Drop it. It's on you to realize this minuscule nature of money, for example, right? And everything else that is of that same nature. It is on you to realize that. And it is on you to simply let go of it. And you don't need anyone's permission to let go of it. You don't need anyone's approval. You don't need anyone's capabilities. You don't need anyone's money. You don't need anyone's resources. You don't need a single other thing. You could let go of everything that stands between you and peace in the middle of a war zone. Many have. Many have. I'm not saying you could only. Many have. And so it's just another illusion that we say, oh, but I have this problem. First of all, problems are illusions, right? But even to say, I have this problem. So until that problem is fixed, and I can't fix it, I just have to wait and hope that it's fixed. Until that happens, I cannot be at peace. If you think like that, then of course you're not going to have peace. You don't want it. You're literally delaying it. You're literally saying, I don't want it yet. It's not time yet. You're literally saying that. So it's on you to let go of all that, right?
Right.
So
I just, I think you answered my question. I think that was
think about that. There's no rush, there's no pressure, there's no deadline. All of that's an illusion. It's just you and your mind, and time does not really exist in that realm. Okay. So you take all of that which does not exist in the first place, all of as much as you need of it, and just think about these things and see it, and maybe start letting go one by one and realize and work on yourself. That's all there is to it. It's a great pleasure, right? You're not incomplete, even as you're working on yourself, even as you still have illusions, even as you still are in the grips of certain identity, of certain ego, of fear, of worry, of anxiety. Even then, you're not incomplete. Just like I say, peace is always there, whether you see it or not. Your true self is always complete, whether you see it or not. So I'm not telling you to work on yourself, to complete yourself, to finally make something of yourself, to finally become whole, to finally become healed. You already are. You already are. And you take all the time you need to realize that. That's your entire work and your entire pleasure and your entire privilege as a human being. Okay?
Right. Okay, that's
All right.
about what I wanted to have.
Yeah,
Have a
and
conversation about.
but thank you for your question and thank you for your thoughts. As always, which is my privilege to say, it's always very relevant to all of our lives, these questions, and you've provided one of those. So I thank you very much for that. I'll move you back to the audience. And again, thanks a lot. That was excellent. And I will invite our next speaker soon. Before that, I do want to say that there's a lot going on in the chat, and I'm wondering, I'm not convinced of anything, I don't have an opinion, I'm not judging on this whatsoever. I am wondering how someone can speak about one thing and listen to another. Does that make sense? Because I don't have that kind of brain. Maybe you guys do. But when I see relatively unrelated conversations going on, I wonder how people can listen to the person who's talking and write at the same time about something else, even if it's slightly different. So I'm just wondering about that. And I feel like I should invite some of those people to speak so that they can explain that to us. Okay, so if I see that going on a lot, I might ask one of you to explain that to me because I don't understand it. I don't have that kind of brain. I'm sort of, I suspect that I'm a little below average intelligence sometimes. So maybe it's just me. Maybe other people could do it. But I wonder how that's possible. So maybe one of you will explain that to us one day. And if you do want to talk about these things, I'm not saying talk about them. I'm not saying the conversations are not worth anything. Not at all. But if you do want to discuss these things, then why don't you come and speak about them? Because the chat is always going on. There's always chat 24/7. But the kinship meetings, live, people here speaking, talking, that's a very, very special thing. It only goes on once a week. So why don't we do what's special always that's in front of us and not the thing we can always do at any other time? So that's just what I'm wondering about. Again, no judgment there. I really don't understand, so I'm just sharing a confusion. That's all. And I will invite our next speaker here. And there we go.
So I was thinking about the question of the week, and we have had some great discussions on it.
Yeah.
And I think by now we have all come to the realization that all wrongdoings are done in misguidedness, and there is no such thing as evil. But I wanted to share a few thoughts that I've been having about a question that's very related to this, mm-hmm. not exactly on the question of the week. So the thought that people have struggled with is this. It seems to me it's this, that if there is no evil, and if the universe or God is ever loving, then why is there so much suffering? And I think the Western school of thought has called this the problem of evil, and it has gone on for a long time now. So I was watching a video on this, and I just wanted to share a few thoughts that the video made me think and how it connects to what we have been talking about here. So this question has been asked across all ages, not only in religion, but also in philosophy, in literature and theology, that if God exists and if there is no evil, then why is there so much suffering? And quite interestingly, in 1971, someone from the University of Wisconsin, Arthur Herman, he wrote a book called The Problem of Evil and Indian Thought. Although he named it The Indian Thought, what he did was he did a survey of all the answers that has been given to this question across all religions and philosophies. And he summarized his understanding by giving 23 answers in his book. Now, the person who was narrating all of this, he said that none of the answers are satisfying in that book. Because if it was, then people would have stopped asking this question. But he also narrated a story from an Indian mystic where that mystic indirectly gave an answer, And I found this very satisfying. So I just wanted to share that and connect it to what we have been thinking. So this man walks up to this Indian master and asks him the same question, that if the evil doesn't exist, then why is there so much suffering? And this Indian mystic, who was a very deep believer in God, he replies by saying that, oh, this is all God's Leela. In India, we use the word Leela to mean the divine will of God. So he says that this is God's will and we cannot do anything about it. Then the man who was not satisfied by this answer, he tells the master back that it might be divine play to him, but it is death to us. At this point, the master just asked a simple question back, and nobody could say anything to that. So the master asked that, you say it is death to us, but who are you? Do you even know who you are? And this is where the video ended. And it made me think that, you know, all of it comes down to knowing thyself. Because if we know our true nature, then we would realize that all these people whom we are terming as evil or bad, they are the same instance of the God as we are, right? So if we know our true nature, then we can transcend all these dualities of suffering, good and bad, and evil and good. So how does this connect to what we have discussed before? As I said, it all comes down to knowing thyself. And you shared a quote from one of the Indian texts, I think it was the Upanishad, where you say that, know that by the knowing of which all things are known. And in the same text, there is another sentence. It says that the knower of the self will transcend all sorrow and suffering. And all of this, although it was written, or probably it was more popular in India, but this is not an Indian thought. This is a very universal thought. Because when the Indian mystic was living at that time, around the 1800s, one of our very good friends in America, Emerson, also wrote a poem on Brahma. Now, the Brahma is the word that the Indians use for the supreme truth. It is also the name of the Hindu god of creation. And I just want to read the first four lines from Emerson's poem, because I think it captures the whole essence of the Bhagavad Gita. So Emerson writes, if the red slayer think he slays, or if the slain think he is slain, they know not well the subtle ways I pass and I turn again. So he's saying that the slayer and the slain is the same essence. So if we come to this realization, then all of our conflicts will dissolve, because we are always at a conflict. Today it might be someone from our family, tomorrow it might be someone from our neighborhood, the day after it might be our own country, and the next day it would be some another country who is committing a war crime. But terming them as evil or bad just keeps adding to our conflict. We go nowhere near the peace that we want to be. So I felt that we were mostly confused about how evil can exist if the universe is ever living. And this is what I was thinking. And I think it all comes down to knowing oneself and knowing our true nature. And I just wanted to know, what do you think about this?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, thank you for sharing all those beautiful things. This is exactly the work of life in physical terms. What you've clearly been doing, like reading that book that you mentioned of the answers, the compilation of the answers to the question of evil, to of course read poets, writers, thinkers who think about these things. This is exactly what I'm talking about when I say, if you dedicate yourself to your own personal exploration of timeless and universal ideas, that you will find your own unique answers to every question you've ever had. This is exactly what that looks like. And thank you for demonstrating that. And of course, see, by doing that, someone wrote an entire book of all the answers they could possibly find to the question of evil, and none of them satisfied anyone. But this one that you came up with yourself through your own personal exploration of timeless and universal ideas, like I say, you have found an answer that satisfies you. And whether it satisfies me or anyone else in this chat, you don't even care. Because you don't need other people's approval. You don't need other people to agree with you for your own, for the things that your personal exploration of timeless and universal ideas has yielded for you. And when you can satisfy yourself in this way, then you are at peace. You need nothing. You want for nothing, literally. You are satisfied in your answers. You are continuing to look for answers to other questions. And it's the greatest joy, the greatest pleasure, and the greatest privilege to you, I'm sure. And this is what I'm talking about this whole time when I say the work of life. Each and every individual needs to do that for themselves. That's why going to the church, going to the mosque, going to the synagogue, going to the philosophy department is not going to do anything for you if you just expect to go there and to be handed something. No one can hand you peace. No one can hand you your own unique answers to the questions that you've always had. No one can do that. Only you can do that. And I just want to point that out once again. This is a demonstration on how to do it. And it didn't necessarily cost you a single dime. All it cost you was your dedication, your attention, which is the most important thing, but it is available to everyone. We all have it. We don't all have wealth or the intelligence to understand everything. But that what you just presented requires neither intelligence nor wealth. And you've shown it. You said, here's an age-old question. What's a bigger, more fundamental, older question than the question of evil? And you've answered it for yourself. Again, no one else might be satisfied here. I'm not saying they're not, but it could be possible. And it wouldn't matter to you. So why don't all those people who are dissatisfied in that book and in the world and everywhere else with any answer to any question, why don't they go and satisfy themselves? Why don't they do it? Every single reason why they don't is what stands in between them and peace. And they happen to be all very, very, very similar, if not the same reasons for all of us when we don't have peace. And so this is a universal experience, and it's a timeless experience, and the solution is timeless and equally universal. And everything I ever say seems to be to show someone this timelessness and this universality and the same solution to the same problems. But anyway, to answer your question specifically, I 100% agree when I, not that it matters that I agreed, but this is why I agree. Whenever I hear people talking about not only evil, but suffering, like you say, why is there so much suffering? If evil doesn't exist, or if God didn't will it to be that way, or whatever they want to say, why is there so much suffering? And it always intuitively makes me think, suffering to whom? Who is suffering?
Right.
You're saying there is suffering. I'm not saying there's suffering. Nature doesn't say there is suffering. God doesn't say there's suffering. The universe doesn't say there is such a thing as suffering. You are the one saying that. And you might be right, you might be wrong, I don't know. But can we acknowledge that we are the ones saying that there is suffering and are looking for a justification for it when it is an opinion that there is suffering? Suffering for whom? Who is the one suffering? Are you suffering? Then let's look at the reasons why you think you are suffering. 9 times out of 10, it will be anxiety, it will be fear. But there are so many people who believe anxiety or fear to be an illusion, to be something not real. So they don't suffer from it. So we can't say that there is suffering, we can only say that we suffer. And it's true, people do suffer. But what is the nature of their suffering? I don't know. I'm truly saying I don't know. We'd have to look at that. But the question of why is there suffering is an invalid one. Right? When people say, oh, right. the fish doesn't want to be caught in a flood, the whale doesn't want to be beached, you're assuming that. We don't know that. Like, what is truly good? What is suffering to a fish? We don't know that. You know, is a fish ever really sitting there thinking at any occasion, I am suffering right now? And yeah, we just assume that everything wants to live for as long as possible. And that might be true in terms of like a survival instinct. But we as humans know better than any animal, it appears, that there are higher reasons, that there is a higher good than the will to survive, the reflex, the instinct to do so in certain situations. So I might be very willing to forego that, and I wouldn't call that suffering. And when the forest burns, does the forest say I'm suffering? We assume that the forest is suffering when it burns, when it's dry, when it floods, or whatever all the things that can happen. We assume all these things. Suffering from the perspective of whom? If it's your perspective, like your individual perspective, fine, let's talk about it, right? But to say humanity is suffering, the planet is suffering, some people even say God is suffering. How can you don't get to say that. You just don't. This is a fact. I'm not saying I'm offended by that. You don't get to say. You literally don't, because it's not your perspective. You're assigning, again, a role to someone else. You're confused or ignorant of the true causes of things, and so you're just making up one to fill in the blank. And you don't do it with any bad intent. But you can't do it. You literally cannot. You do not have that competence. You do not have that ability. We as humans don't, right? I don't even know how another human being thinks about something. How can I say anything about humanity in general, animals, the planet, about the nature of suffering? So to me, it's just an invalid question, but it is invalid due to the reasons the way you explained it, right? Like Emerson says, I go in and out, I come about or I go out, whatever he said, in this way. It's just the way that one comes in and one goes out.
Right.
To call that suffering is objectively an opinion. And this doesn't mean that wrongdoing doesn't exist, right? When someone impedes on our freedom, then they're doing wrong. But it's up to me to suffer from that or not. And it's up to me also to assign that person intent. Like, are they doing it because they're ignorant? Or are they doing it to make me suffer? Again, what another person thinks will make me suffer is also just an opinion. They might try to make me suffer and it's not suffering to me at all. Or they're not trying to make me suffer, but it's making me suffer. All of this is so subjective. And that's the problem with the idea of evil, with believing in evil, because it is us who's assigning our own opinions, our own perspective to someone else. And we say, this person wouldn't do that if they weren't evil. You don't know that. You just don't. And it shouldn't matter to you also, by the way. And we need to stop assigning, because that's a form of judging. We need to stop assigning intention. We need to stop assigning motives and causes to things that we have no insight into. We just don't.
Yeah. This assigning is like it's a separator, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, I can give a profane example. Like when you do math, you know, when you are just multiplying or dividing by the number one, everything is simple and true. And like the problem starts when you start arithmetic operations with numbers greater than one. And I think the same is true for us. When we start with two or more than two, now we are separating us from all the other people. But in reality, we are the same instance of God as they are, right? So if we do not see that oneness, that creates all this separation, and that ultimately leads to all our misery. So this assigning has to stop. And I think we can stop it. There is no better way to stop it other than by knowing thyself. As you very, very nicely point the questioner to the question that who in you is suffering? Who in you is suffering from this or that whenever people ask you questions? And I think we have to keep doing it more until we realize that, you know,
exactly.
The main part of us do not suffer anything.
Cannot, because it's not physical, it's not material. And if you notice, every suffering, every evil is a material, physical thing that people mention.
Right.
The awareness cannot suffer. There's no such thing. Because it goes on, it was there before you. It's something you partake in. It's something that cannot be touched. Like whenever I talk to people about justice is a concept. It's an idea. It cannot be touched. So when mm-hmm. and then people immediately go to the justice system, like in a government or in society, which has nothing to do with justice. It's our profane, material, physical way of executing laws. But if we fail to properly execute a law, justice is not harmed. And if we manage to stay true to what is just in our laws, then justice is not ennobled. It is not made better. It is not honored. It doesn't care. Nothing changes about justice, no matter how well we adhere to it or how so-called against it or how misaligned we are to it. Nothing changes. About the question of evil, also another thing is that awareness, this is so important. There's so many confusions when it comes to evil, and it leads us to the idea that people know what they're doing. And I've been noticing that more and more. The more I deal with evil, also in myself, I've been noticing this confusion more. That someone is aware of wrongdoing does not mean they are willing in their wrongdoing. When people realize that they're doing something wrong, like let's say they're overcome by some desire, by a lust even, right? And they know it's destructive. They know how it ends. They know each time it wasn't really satisfying them. It was just a desire that they did not have the willpower to stop. So they know it's going on, very much so. And they're carrying it out. Without them, it doesn't happen. They can't just sit back and let it happen. They're actively making it happen. And they're very much aware that it's happening. And they see it. But they're not really willing. See what I mean?
Right.
And yeah. But we look at that, again, from the outside. And we say, that guy knows exactly what he's doing. He's the one carrying out the action. Don't you know that violence is wrong? Don't you know that stealing is wrong? Don't you know that whatever is wrong? Yes, they do know that it's wrong. And yes, they do nevertheless do it. But that doesn't mean they're willing.
Yeah.
Because no one wants to be ignorant. No one wants to be overcome by desire. No one wants to be the person who does something because they're too weak to stop it. And no one wants to be a thief. No one really wants to be violent. They all do it because either they can't stop themselves or the reward is too good. And their ignorance lies in the fact that violence can give you a reward, by the way.
Absolutely, yeah.
So when I say people are ignorant, when I say people are unknowing, unwilling as they're doing evil, I do not mean that they don't know what they're doing. I know that they know what they're doing. But they're ignorant when it comes to the ultimate end of what they're doing and why they're doing it. They think that even though it is wrong to do violence, they think it is part of justice to do violence. They don't know that justice cannot be touched. They don't know that justice does not need their support. They don't know that justice is not asking for their help. They don't know that justice cannot be defended. They don't know that justice cannot be destroyed, no matter who does what. They don't know that they don't need to prevent this other person from being misaligned from justice in order to protect justice. Justice, right. Truth, goodness does not need your defense. And so when someone says, I'm protecting what is right, there's a term called defender of the faith, right? King Charles, for example, his title is technically defender of the faith. And it was Queen Elizabeth's title before him. The monarch of England is the defender of the Christian faith. It's a title. And anyone only defends the faith because they think they're defending truth. Truth does not need your defense. So every single war that is conducted in the defense of truth is wrong and is ignorant. Do they not know that they're conducting war? Do they not know that they're going to kill people? Do they not know that they're intentionally looking to kill tens of thousands of enemy units? And don't I know that they know that that's wrong? Of course I know that they know that that's wrong. But they think they're defending the faith. What will we do without our faith? What is the point of living without truth, without beauty, without goodness, without honoring God? Again, I'm not saying that. They're saying that. God does not need to be honored. God does not need your defense. God, because God cannot be touched, cannot be attacked by anyone anyway. But you don't know that. You're ignorant of that. And this is what I mean when I say that all evil acts are misguidance. Everything that we consider evil is in fact misguided. This is why. I don't care how large the circle extends. I don't care how long the list of means is to the ultimate goal. And I don't care if we don't even know what the ultimate goal is. Just because we don't know what the ultimate goal is does not mean we get to assign someone evil intentions. And once again, this is another confusion. People think when you defend or when you say that all evil is misguidedness, that that's a defense of evil people. Not a single thing changes. If you're misguided and you murder, it's just as bad as if you're evil and you murder. Not a single thing changes, not a single thing. People think you're defending people, you're making it better, or you're allowing them to do these things. Not at all. This is for myself, this understanding, so that I can be at peace. Because this concept, this notion of evil is what stands in between me and my peace. Why would I let it stand there? Nothing changes about the person or what they did and how wrong it is what they did. It only changes that I don't have to sit there in resentment and hatred and an equal ignorance of what is really going on. And so, yeah, what you're saying is absolutely related, as you say. Very important. Suffering from the perspective of whom, right? Yeah. So as you say, yeah, whenever we assign other people suffering, whenever we say, hey, these people are suffering, why are they suffering? Why does there have to be suffering in the world? You are assigning them suffering. You don't get to do that. And whenever you say, I am suffering, then it is your perspective. And then the question really becomes relevant. Who are you even? Do you even know that? Because if you knew, as you say, if you knew who you truly were, you would know that you cannot suffer. Again, does that mean you cannot experience wrongdoing, that you cannot experience pain, death, loss of material things, loved ones, whatever? All of that. Pain is, I think Marcus Aurelius says that, right? Pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the same thing. Since you are not your body, pain is not necessarily suffering. Pain is something the body experiences. And you're tied to the body, of course, but you are not the body. So when does pain become suffering? It becomes suffering, it seems to me, when you identify with your body, when you don't know who you are because you're not your body. So yeah, very, very, very relevant. Yeah.
And who can be a better example than Socrates, right? I mean, all he went after was truth, but people didn't know and they were misguided and they condemned him to death. But even he didn't label them as evil. He just accepted reality and let truth take its own course, right? So if Socrates doesn't label his murderers as evil, then who are we to label someone as evil? I mean, what do we even know about ourselves? It exactly. amazes me every time I think about it.
It's all about perspective. And knowing thyself is having the right perspective, right? That's the whole point.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, Socrates realized these people are defending truth. You know?
Mm-hmm.
These people are defending what they think is right. They're wrong. They're wrong. Truth does not meet their defense, and what they think is truth is not truth. But that's what they're doing in their heads. And to defend truth is not evil. Whether you're not supposed to defend truth or not, that's what they're doing. They're defending truth. And so how can that possibly be evil? It's wrong. It's wrong. It's misguided. It's ignorant. They will never have peace with that attitude, with that mindset. They will always cause wrongdoing, and they will always cause harm, chiefly to themselves. But they're not evil. And that doesn't make it any better. I want to say that again. It doesn't make it any better. You're not letting anyone off by saying that. Not one bit. No, you're just understanding what's going on rather than labeling it evil, which is just a catch-all term for everything you don't like. You're just going to the ground of it. You're seeing that it's perspective. You're seeing that you're assigning things. You're seeing that you shouldn't do that. You're seeing that it's costing you your own peace and that you yourself are being ignorant by doing that. You're seeing all these things. And so, yeah, thank you for sharing that. Did you have anything else? I didn't want to cut you off.
No, that's all. Thank you so much. I really wanted to hear your insights on this, and you explained it beautifully. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. That was very, very valuable. And once again, I'll move you to the audience, but I want to say once again, I hope you see how valuable Emerson is. And I hope, as I pointed out before, you see what it means to do the work of life in physical terms, in daily terms. This is what you're supposed to make the time and space for in your daily life, to read the relevant books. So you have a question, right? You're dealing with evil. You're doing literally God's work when you deal with the question of evil for yourself. And so what can I do? My process, for example, just as an example, my personal process of dealing with evil has been, for example, that I thought to myself, how can I understand evil? Let's say evil is a real thing. It exists. Then I want to understand it. If it's not a real thing, I want to see that it's not a real thing. So what can I do to distinguish? What can I do to find that out? For me personally, the first step was to read the biography of the most commonly referred to as evil person, which was Hitler, right? I read his biography and I found even more wrongdoings of his than I knew existed before. but I could not find a single evil thing. Because every single thing he ever did, in his mind, not in truth, but in his mind, was justified somehow, in some way, as paying off at the end and being this great service to his country, to the entire world in many cases. How can you call someone who's looking to benefit the entire world evil? He could not have been more wrong. He could not have been more wrong. But there's no evil to be found. It's the truth. And so that was very amazing. So that was part of my process, right? And Pijus just shared how he dealt with the issue partially. I'm sure there are many things that are being done by him, but that this is what it means to be engaged in the work of life. So I just want to point that out again and again because it's so important. And I will take our next speaker, like I said.
Hello. So in order to ask my questions, I have to give you a little bit of context.
All right.
Right now, well, this is actually my third kinship meeting and the first time speaking. So I don't know what made me speak today. Maybe it is that there's more chaos in my life right now, or I don't really know. So right now there's a big gap between my high standards for myself, running an international brand, pushing for rapid growth, and the chaotic way my days play out. I'm lost to impulses, procrastinations on small tasks. I'd say scattered focus despite big goals. And I think between feeling capable and totally lost, you know. I am quite young. I was born in 04, and the pressure to succeed fast turns every unproductive day into self-judgment. You know, I'm very harsh on myself. Sometimes, most of the time, my inner voice is really cruel. So based on this, I have three questions. I hope that's okay. I hope there's not too many.
No, it's fine.
Yeah, so the first one is on daily practices. I guess my question is, how can I build a 2 or 3 simple daily stoic practices to control my impulses and close this gap between my standards and reality? You know, turning this chaos into a steady progress on the brand that I'm working on. This is literally the project of my life right now, and without overwhelming myself.
Are the other questions related?
The second one is about discipline. You know, I don't know, what does true discipline look like without being cruel to myself? How do I find that middle ground, especially when running an international brand, an international business that demands also constant output? And I can also ask the third one. The third one is about ambition and pressure. You know, as ambition grows with the business, anxiety and delay grows as well. The question is, how can I handle ambition in a healthy way, deal with pressure to succeed young without judging my whole worth by daily productivity, and use simple philosophical journaling exercises, because I started also carrying an agenda all the time and start writing things down so I don't forget and have a line of what's going on in my life. So I stop swinging between feeling highly capable and completely adrift, you know, and live more intentionally amid business pressure.
Okay. Are you religious at all? Do you have a religion, or are you not so much believing in God and things like that?
I did not, but when I was younger, because of my family's Christian, and they usually put the religion, since you are a young kid, they transmit it to you. They don't let you choose, because I find that you need to learn about every religion, and when you are ready above 18 years old, you need to choose if you want to choose. So basically, I was given this religion, like Christian, right? But I didn't. At a certain age, I stopped going to the church, and I stopped believing. And since then, I'm on this journey of learning about everything. But right now, I'm not sure about the idea of the divine, to be honest.
All right. No, that's totally fine. I was just wondering. So I want to tell you this, and then I also want to tell you why that is the case. You know how you are essentially suffering, right? All these things that you're explaining right now, that as your ambition grows, your worry grows,
the
and
pressure,
the pressure grows,
the pressure
the stress
as well.
Grows.
And I know you said in the discussion with Shavim, if I say his name correctly, that there is no pressure, but in this case, in the professional case, there is the pressure of money. There is the pressure also in a personal way. I find it that there is a pressure of time, because I'm growing older. I want to do something with my life. I want to why my parents are still alive. I want to give something back, you know. So I find that there is pressure.
Right. And there absolutely is pressure. You're absolutely right. Because you have this idea that you need to give something to your parents. And I want to ask you the pressure of time, the need to have this business to be successful, not only successful, but successful as quickly as possible and in a short amount of time so that your parents can still benefit from it, and all the other requirements that you put, or all the requirements that you are facing right now. Who requires any of these things?
If I think about it, it's just me. It's just me. It's me wanting to give them. It's me wanting to have. So, yeah.
And why do you want to do that? Why do you want to put those requirements on yourself? Because clearly, it's you, as you said, it's no one else putting that on you. And if you had said that someone else is doing it, I would have told you that no one else has the right to do that, right? But you seem to already know that it's you doing it. So the question is simply, why do you choose to do that?
To suffer, you mean?
Yeah, to put those, I mean, those requirements are making you suffer. You're right. But since you know that you are the one putting those requirements on you, the question seems to be then, naturally, why you choose to put those requirements on yourself?
That's a good question. I think it is a natural self-improvement need. That's what I'd say. And virtue, but often gets really twisted by the ego, you know, because I have that as well. I want to realize something, I want to do better.
So you...
I think it's a natural impulse for growth, and ego has something to do with it as well. And I think I have it's a fear of mediocrity as well.
Who is the one who is in danger of mediocrity?
Myself.
Right.
Me.
Who is that?
Yeah, it is me. I think it's the high drive that makes a paralysis from self-judgment. Fear of failure.
Who is afraid of failure?
Me.
Who
is
that?
It's always me.
Who is that?
I don't know. I guess that's a very difficult question to answer.
So, You don't know who you are. You don't know what you're doing. You don't know why you're doing it. And you wonder why you're stressed out and confused and are suffering. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. So, and I could tell from the first 6 seconds of you talking about it that this was the case, and I'll tell you why. Because you were coming here trying to use philosophy, which is nothing other than the personal exploration of truth, to further something that is below truth. As having grown up Christian, you might have heard of the idea of idolatry, right?
Yep.
What is idolatry? Yep.
To idolize someone that is perfect in a way that to follow its rules and to respect it clearly.
Right. And God said, right, if you have any gods before me, if you put anything over me, God, then you are unworthy of me. Right. And God, in the real sense, not what most Christians or most religious people think of God, but what God truly is truth. And truth is reality. Because reality is everything that there is, period. Everything that mm-hmm. exists, everything that it has being, everything that has existence is what reality is. And everything that exists, everything that is here, everything that is there, everything that is also true. Otherwise, it wouldn't exist. Right? It wouldn't be real if it wasn't true, and it wouldn't be true if it wasn't real. And so God, in that sense, God is reality. God is everything that there is, existence, all of being. Right. And so in that sense, God is truth. When a true Christian says God, this is what they mean. And most Christians are not true Christians, right? But so this is what it means when God says in the Bible or elsewhere and other religions also, right? If you put anything above me, if you have any false idols, because I am the true idol, so to speak, right? God is the true, is the highest good. If you put anything above truth, in that sense, no longer saying God, if you put anything above truth, you become unworthy of truth. And you came here, which is totally natural and understandable, and everyone's done it. There's no judgment in what I'm saying. I'm simply discerning what has happened, right? This is fact.
Sure.
You came here to use truth, to utilize truth for something that is below truth, right? You're coming here looking for journaling practice, looking for knowledge, looking for a tool that you can use to further your business, which you don't know why you're doing it. You don't know who you are, and you don't know what it is, and you don't know where you are, who you are, and when you are. And so you've put something above truth. You've put your business above truth because you're confused about who you yourself are. You're confused about why you're suffering. Yet you identify the cause of suffering to be your own actions, but you don't know the cause and motivation of those actions. So you've put last things first and first things last, and the priorities are jumbled. And I'm not saying anything that you haven't said, by the way. I'm not judging your priorities to be out of order, right? You are the one who's seeing this already. So we're just both talking about an objective fact here. And so in the same way, you also know that the answer is to prioritize that which should come first. And those requirements that you put on yourself are not only not of the highest importance, they're not even real. You are seeking so-called self-advancement without knowing who the self is. So you don't even know what you're advancing, what you're trying to advance. And because you don't know what you're trying to advance, you are not advancing it. You're making it suffer. Because you put all your ambition into making this business as good as it can be. So you're looking for self-improvement, but in fact, what you're doing is self-diminishing. In other words.
You're right. I've been mixing business achievements with my true identity, and maybe that's what's causing the suffering as well.
Because you started the business to give yourself a better life, I'm sure.
Exactly.
And now the business is worsening your life because you're stressed out, you're anxious, you're in fear, you're worrying all the time. You're extremely stressed, which is neither good for your mental health nor your physical health. And the more money you make, the less security you have. The bigger the business grows, the more worries you have. And so this is self-defeating, right? You need to put truth first. I always say there's the work of bread, right? That which pays your bills, the work that feeds you. And then there's the work of life. And the work of life is to know thyself. Look how good you are at the work of bread and how much you're suffering in the work of life. Because the bread is there to feed you to do something. Right? The work of bread is there to support the work of life. And you're literally coming here to use the work of life to support the work of bread.
Yeah, you're right.
You understand?
That's spot on.
You are supposed to go to work, do whatever you need to do to take care of your physical needs, to be able to have the time and space to figure out, who am I? What responsibilities do I have to my parents? Do I really have any? And if I choose to take care, not because I have to, not because someone tells me to, not because it's my duty, but because I choose to support my parents, just because they're great people. They're good people. They're lovely people. I love being around them. And I just like to support good people, not because they're my parents, but because they're good, right? If that is the case, that's another thing for you to examine. But if that is the case, there's nothing wrong with doing it for that reason, right? Mm-hmm. But you need to understand that you are not required to do that. If you want to do it, it is your privilege to do it. And the privilege would not stress you out. Something that you have the great honor and privilege of doing should not be something that stresses you out. Only something that you have to do that you don't want to do would stress you out. So I think there's a realization to be had there. But again, that's on you. That's for you to put into the work of life and to figure that out.
Yep.
But I just want to tell you care and love are not the same thing. To take care of someone, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
I have watched the care, the difference between care and love video on YouTube. Yeah.
So that's important to realize. Right? It's important to realize that care is not the same thing as love. If you take care of your parents, that does not mean that you love them. And if you love them, it doesn't mean that you need to take care of them to be able to love them. Those are two separate things. And care is not wrong. To take care of something is not wrong. If you have a plant in your house and you love plants, of course you're going to take care of it and it's going to be a great joy to you. But if you think that in order to be worthy of love, in order to be a good son, you need to take care of people that you don't even like very much, then you are literally asking for suffering and for disappointment and for resentment. And if you truly love someone, you will take care not to take care of them. Because care turns into resentment. Whenever you have to do something because you think it's your duty or it's a requirement on you, then you're doing it largely unwillingly and you're doing it with resentment. And if you truly love your parents, you don't want to resent them. So all you need to make sure is to see where are these requirements coming from and what do I really want to do versus I think I need to do. And so you have to be very careful. Take care of your parents as much as you truly want, but not one bit more than that. Because every single thing that you do beyond truly wanting it out of love will turn into resentment. And if you truly love your parents, you don't want to risk resenting them, right? So you need to get rid of all those so-called requirements and you need to do everything out of a privilege, out of love and not out of care, out of privilege, not out of duty. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And it's a lot for me to think about, especially on knowing myself and in the future.
And the way to know yourself, by the way, is to know who you are not. The way you know yourself is by knowing who you are not. And look, just in this conversation, we've already figured out several things that you are not. You are not your requirements. You are not the success of your business. Your being does not depend on that, right? You are not your responsibilities. You are not the dreams and goals that you have. You are not the international or national nature of your business. You are not any of those things. Look how much more self you have now, even though you're lessened,
that's amazing.
So to speak. Right?
Amazing.
We have just lessened you, but we have increased you just by getting rid of baggage. And so if you continue to do this, if you continue to let go of, I call them rocks in your pockets, right? Because they're just there in your pockets and they're weighing you down and they're not you. So they're rocks in your pockets. If you continue to go into your pockets and take out rocks and let go of them, you will literally become lighter and freer and at peace. And whatever is left of you is the true you. And the true you does not need to prove anything. The true you doesn't have any requirements. The true you does not need to suffer. The true you does not need to delay being at peace. The true you does not need to experience worry, anxiety, stress on a daily basis or in fact at all. And to realize these things, to not only know these things because I told you, but to believe them within yourself because you yourself see this to be true, that's the work of life. And never, ever again put the work of bread in front of the work of life. And if you don't do that, then this beautiful work of bread that you've been building up, which is successful and is giving you all these resources, it's going to be the greatest pleasure to you to not only acquire those resources, but then to go and put them to use and become literally better. And I'm not saying better according to my definition, better according to your definition. Becoming the person who you know you need to be. And so lastly, I will also just say a couple practical things, which you actually asked for. But
yes.
Now you really know what to put those practical things towards, right? Before, it was just going to support something fake, something destructive, something self-destructive almost, right?
That's very helpful,
so now hopefully you will put it to the right use. I recommend that you start reading books that feel relevant to you. You know, I recommend books. They're on the website. So you can take a look at those, but don't read any of them if they don't speak to you already, right? If there's not something there that's drawing you, they're just suggestions. And so I recommend you do that. Epictetus, Marcus Aurelius, Seneca, right? We have a Seneca book club going that you can be a part of if you'd like. Seneca is always a great.
I'm aware of all of it. I will check the website once again, and the book certainly. Yep.
Yeah. So read, and then you also, it sounds like you heard about what I say about journaling. I recommend that you start journaling so that you not only hear those thoughts, but that you actually make them your own, so that whenever you're confused about something or you're having a challenge in your life, you don't even need to ask anyone else. You've already made those ideas that are relevant for those situations your own, and you believe in them and you trust in them and you know them really well personally. And so that's also the work of life in terms of logistics, right? Make the time and space every day. Read a little bit, journal a little bit, and just be with these ideas as much as you want to. Again, not more than you want to, in the sense that, oh, I should be doing the work of life, I should be doing more, I should be improving, I should be happier. Don't listen to any of that. If it's 5 minutes, 5 minutes, that's totally fine. But try to do it every day and try to do it as a way of life. That's the only practical thing I can tell you. The rest is all up to you. You'll just keep reading books that are relevant to the questions you have in your mind. And hopefully you'll write about them too to make them your own. Okay?
That's very helpful. Thank you, Atish.
Absolutely. And hope to see you around. Hope you speak again. Okay?
So yeah, whenever is good for you. Yep, for sure.
Okay.
Thank you.
I wish you a lot of success, and I want to repeat one more time. The universe, the world, requires nothing of you. Not a single thing. All your requirements come from yourself. So drop them. Okay? Or do them because you love doing it, because it's a privilege to you, not because it's a duty. So if it stresses you out, it's wrong.
Okay.
Okay.
Got it.
Thank you very much for your question. That was relevant
to
everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
And it was great to
thanks, everyone.
It was great to hear from you. I'll move you to the audience.
Okay, the same.
And I see Amin is back. He wants to try again, I think. So we'll have him real quick. See if
Mike's
it's working.
Duck.
Hello. Wait. Hi. Yes, it's working.
There you go.
Excellent.
All right, guys. Well, hi, everyone. First and foremost, Atish, I just wanted to take a moment to thank you for, first and foremost, allowing me to speak, but of course, all the work that you have done and continue doing for us. I think I speak on behalf of everyone when I say that we are eternally grateful. So very quickly, I just wanted to share my thoughts on, I believe it was Shivam who asked the question. Sorry if I mispronounced your name, brother. But he mentioned, how do we differentiate between peace and happiness? And what I wanted to say about that is that for me, peace, or rather how you achieve peace, is simply through submitting to the way of the universe, submitting to God, if you will, or whatever you want to call it, submitting to nature. And I think the issue for a lot of people when it comes down to submission is that for whatever reason, there is a negative connotation around that word. As if, for whatever reason, that, you know, it's a sign of weakness. But if you really examine the nature of submission, it is more so a sign of strength and courage rather than anything else. I believe, for example, it was Epictetus who said that even if you must die, must you die bawling? I believe I may be paraphrasing, but something along those lines, right? And for example, Atesh, like yourself, I've heard you several times mention this specific analogy or some variation of it. You can either be taken to a place, right? You can either go willingly or be dragged, right? And I assume you're aware of Alan Watts, right? Pretty popular philosopher himself. One of the analogies he gives is that if you, you know, if you have a stream of water and you are going against it, you feel all this resistance. But if you accept the direction of the stream and you go with it, all of a sudden you are at, you know, in this tranquil state because you don't feel resistance. So for me, peace is just accepting the way of the universe. And I don't personally consider myself a like a religious person, a practicing Muslim, but I was born in a, or rather I am born into a Muslim family. And there's a lot of teachings in Islam that I do appreciate. And I just wanted to share with you and the rest of the audience here, in case you guys weren't aware, but the literal definition of being a Muslim is simply to submit to the will of God. That's it. I think that is the main way that you can truly find peace. And if you fight it, then that is how you will find yourself in a state that is the opposite. So I just wanted to quickly share my kind of my take on how one achieves peace. The question I had for you, Atesh, I actually made a post in the general channel about it, is that when it comes down to identifying who you want to allow into your life, who you want to associate with, and who you want to keep close, what is the framework that you use to not necessarily condemn them for life or hate on them or anything like that, but just to identify whether or not I should allow this person near to me? If I may, I just wanted to quickly share what framework I've kind of been using with, I feel like, quite a bit of success. But basically, the framework is this. There's three different tiers, right? And each tier has a slightly different weights, okay? So the greatest weight should be carried on how this person treats you. Slightly less weight should be put on how you observe them treat others. And then lastly, you know, and certainly not any less important, however, again, slightly less weight, should be on how you are told by a third party how they treat other people. And I think the missing piece of the puzzle for most is that they just rely on tier number one. Well, if I'm being treated well, then this person must be an amazing person. But the issue with that is it's not a strong enough filtering mechanism in case this person is using you for some hidden agenda or is trying to maintain a relationship with you for, you know, a reason that we, you know, you and I would consider to be, you know, the opposite of authentic. So I found that if you use these three tiers, you're able to better gauge character. And again, I don't want to use the word judge, right? I'm using the word gauge. And to me, if they don't meet these standards, then this, again, does not mean that we condemn them for life. It just means that this person needs to take a step back, do the inner work, and before I can allow them to get closer to me, they need to kind of meet that standard. So again, I'm totally open to hearing your take on that. But yeah, just wanted to kind of ask that question, if I may. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for not only your question, but also sharing how you go about this, because this is one of the biggest questions, at least in our sort of more practical daily lives, right? How do we discern good influences from not good ones? And of course, we have the right to spend time with someone or not spend time with someone. And so if we have that right, how do we exercise that right to the best of our abilities and the most efficiently and all that? So it's a very, very important part of life. And, you know, there's a lot also to say about it, I do have to say. So I'm just trying to decide what I'd like to focus on. I guess I do want to say, before we even get into that, just the fact that you shouldn't need anyone, right? You don't want to need someone. So if we are wrong out of the gate, no matter what method of discernment we use, if we are using it to discern which of the people that are available to us, which of them may fill our need. If we're looking to fill a need, we are wrong out of the gate, no matter what method we use. We need to come to a place through inner work, through our own work, to only want people, if we want them, to want them, not to need them. There's a big difference between wanting and needing. People who need people cannot be alone. They don't like themselves. They cannot stand themselves. Literally, they cannot stand themselves. They need distractions. They need other people. They need things happening. And so they look for people that they may use to that end. But someone who simply wants someone will say, well, I love the world of ideas. I love thinking about justice. I love thinking about, is evil a real thing? Or what is evil? What is the nature of evil? How could we avoid it in ourselves? Or what do we do? Blah, blah, blah. I love thinking about these things, and I would like someone else who thinks deeply. And I would love to exchange some views. I don't need to, but I would like to. And so then the method that we use even becomes relevant, right? So I do want to mention that, so as to not give the impression that, oh yeah, we should all be pretty much frantically looking for people to surround ourselves with, and what method do we use that's best for that? So I do want to, you know, make that distinction first. And, you know, regarding your method, again, I don't want to say that any method, not that not any method is not right or wrong, but that your method is doesn't strike me as something that's right or wrong. If it works for you, that's great. You've done it for yourself. For me personally, I feel like you can simplify it even further, and I will suggest that to you, and you can obviously do what you want with it. It's a suggestion. You can adopt some parts of it, reject other parts of it, or reject it all, or adopt it all, whatever it is. To me, a person who has any kind of resentment towards anything or anyone is someone to be avoided. Period. Because a resentful person is an angry person. An angry person is a hateful person. A hateful person is an unaware person. They don't know who they are. They don't know who you are. They don't know what they're doing. They don't know what they should be doing. They don't know what they could be doing. Because they're consumed by hate, by resentment, by anger, by emotion, by the roller coaster. There's nothing wrong with emotions. Okay, and there's nothing unnatural with emotions. And we do not hate emotions, and we do not suppress emotions. But someone who is guided by emotion, someone who makes every decision by emotion, who is led by emotion, in my opinion, is someone to be avoided entirely. Because someone who's led by emotion is someone who's unaware. Emotion is of unawareness, and reason is of awareness, obviously. And reason is opposed to emotion. So someone who's guided by emotion rather than guided by reason is someone who's unaware. They're not of reason. They're of unawareness. And an unaware person will say things recklessly. An unaware person will do things recklessly. An unaware people, a person will treat themselves and others far below their capabilities and their potential. Mm-hmm. And what more do we need to say? They live an unaware life. And you don't want to be around unawareness. You want to be around awareness. You don't want to be around forgetfulness. You want to be around remembrance. We talked about it before. All learning is remembering. And I said it before, don't call anyone a friend who makes you forget. A true friend is someone who makes you remember, who has a bubble around them that is a bubble conducive to remembering, not conducive to forgetting. They'll say, just like the call we just had, Mike, right? A friend will tell him, like I just did.
Yeah, what you told him, exactly.
Yeah,
yes.
He would say, where do your requirements come from? These things that are stressing you out, you're unable to sleep at night, you're experiencing stress, physical, mental health. Where are these requirements coming from? Do you realize that no one's asked them that?
Mm. Yeah.
Because if someone had asked them that, I would not have been the first or the person to ask him what he then would say, oh, I never thought about it like that, or whatever he said, right?
It's important to a true friend, to kind of add to what you're saying, someone who is willing to tell you things you need to hear, even if it may cause some momentary discomfort, rather than telling you things to just double down on your existing beliefs, which they believe is the root cause of this unnecessary suffering or this turmoil that you're experiencing. So you're absolutely correct.
A true friend who is aware, who doesn't need you. See, people who need other people will do whatever they need to do to keep those people around.
Yes, yes.
And so even if they see it, which they won't because they're unaware people, right? Even if they see that their friend is doing something that is not serving them at all, or is a conflict, or they're confused about something, they won't point it out because they will fear that that person will take it wrong, and then they will don't want to be friends with them anymore. So a person who needs you is in fact your enemy. But a person who doesn't need you, however, someone who wants you, will not put you first. They will put truth first.
Yeah, I think that. Sorry to cut you off, Adish. Yeah. I think that ties perfectly into the, you know how like you hear so many people say, oh, there's two types of love. There is conditional and unconditional. But in reality, I don't agree with that. There's only one type of love.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And that is unconditional love.
Right? Yeah.
So what you're saying is another version of unconditional love. Because for love to not be unconditional, it by definition means that it's no longer love. Because there is some hidden agenda behind it.
You're absolutely right. Just like there are not multiple types of truth, your truth, my truth, blah, blah, blah. There's also not multiple types of love. It's a totally false idea that there's such thing as romantic love and then friendship love and then filial love, right, which is family love. This love, that love, it's all one love. It's kinship. And that's why I call these meetings kinship, because there's only one kind of love and it's called kinship, the mutuality in ideas. Because it doesn't matter if someone's your friend, your romantic partner, your family member, or a total stranger. If you do not share a mutuality in beliefs, in ideas, in what friendship is, for example, like we're just talking about, then what do you have in common with them? How can you have friendship love with someone, but not family love, or family love, but you don't have friendship love? What is that? How does that work? That doesn't make any sense. There's one kind of love, and love is not, You know, the only difference, by the way, people love to make everything physical. When they say there are five kinds of love, like romantic love, friendship love, family love, it's all based on physical. As if we are our bodies, as if we are just animals. If you're sexually attracted to a person, then it's romantic love. If the person shares a certain kind of genetic code with you, then it's family love. If you share neither romantic interests nor genetic relations, oh, then it's friendship love.
Mm-hmm.
Love is not something physical.
And I think that's like the perfect litmus test for whether or not it's something is a virtue, because to me, something to qualify as virtue, it needs two key attributes. One, it has to be fully within your control, 100%, not 98%, not 99%, 100% within your control. But also, and I feel like a lot of people are aware of this, but second, but again, not in any less important, is that it needs to be binary in nature. For example, honesty. Like, you can't, if someone says, oh, you should be more honest, well, if there is room for you to be more honest, that means by definition you're being dishonest. So the same thing with love, like it can be binary, right? So 100%, that's the perfect sign that it is indeed, like, true love is virtue. So 100%.
Yeah. And to answer your question also, though, about how to sort of discern those people, that's what I go by. If they are emotional people. And when I say, again, emotional, not denying the emotions, when I say emotion, dominated by emotion, right? Rather than reason, then I stay away from it because they're unaware people. Anger is an emotion. Fear is an emotion. Anger makes us go unaware. Fear makes us go unaware. Anxiety makes us go unaware. We forget who we are. We forget our nature. We forget what is truly important. We think we have requirements that we don't have, right? And it's these emotions that make us think that, or that rather make us forget that it is not the case. And so anyone who is led by emotion is under these false impressions and is leading a life dominated by illusion. And again, this is not judgment at all. Not at all. It's my preference to be in awareness. It's my preference to be in remembrance rather than forgetfulness. And everyone has the right to do whatever they want, as long as it doesn't impede on the freedom of another, right? So if you want to be emotional, if you think emotions are where it's at, and you want to have as much emotion in your life as possible, go ahead. Go ahead. I fully support that, right? I mean, I don't get to support it or not support it. It's just the way it is, and I totally accept that. But it's not what I prefer. And so when I see emotion, I know for myself that this is not a friend for me. That's it. And I think what you were talking about even before that is very valuable about submission. I want to talk about that really quick as well. I think you're 100% right. That's why I called the channel Accepting the Universe, right? To accept is to submit. And you're absolutely right. The ego works overtime to make you believe that accepting something is weakness. That accepting reality, by the way, not an illusion, to accept reality, to accept truth. This person doesn't want to be in my life anymore. Is that an illusion? Is that something I'm making up? No, it's happening. It's reality. This person doesn't want to be in my life anymore. Oh, no, please don't leave. Don't do this to me. I'll change. This is all an attempt to argue with reality, to change reality, to not submit to it, to deny it. And that you're disrespecting yourself, you're disrespecting the person, you are going against truth when you do that. They want to leave you, you have to accept that. Because it's happening, whether you accept it, it's happening. And that's where we say, you know, pain is inevitable. Separation, so to speak, is inevitable. disease is inevitable. Suffering is optional.
For sure. If I may, I think what you're saying is spot on in terms of, again, differentiating between temporary emotions. Like Shivam was saying, how do you differentiate between happiness and peace? And what you're saying, if, for example, if someone wants to leave you, or God forbid, you lose a loved one to death, right? This, for you to be critical of yourself for feeling that emotion, that sadness, is beyond harsh, because to fight that is to basically fight the fact that you're a human being, that you're alive, right? So the goal shouldn't be to suppress these emotions, but if you submit to the universe, if you accept the order of things, it will take you a shorter period of time to return to that tranquil, stable state, which is what we call peace. And that precisely, I think, brings everything full circle, right? That is how you differentiate temporary emotions, whether happiness or sadness. The sooner you can converge to a neutral state of being, the sooner you can be at peace.
Yes. And I'm glad you see all of that. I'm just glad to see it for you, you know, as a friend, you know, because not because it makes me believe in it more and it helps me more. No, it's just beautiful to see in the world this awareness, right? And I wish it to everyone. And so thank you for bringing all of this up. We could talk about this forever, and I think we should, actually. Maybe next kinship you put in a request to speak again and we talk about it more, right? I just feel like I could go on forever, but we're a little bit out of time.
Yeah.
So
thank you very much.
There's no rush. And I was almost deciding, I was like, why not just keep on going? But I feel like there's a merit to sort of keeping a little bit of a time limit on these 100%. Things, just to make it more, more enjoyable. No one wants to listen to a 3-hour thing, you know? Yeah, next time, let's talk about it again. I do want to ask you, though, before you leave, about the question of the week, because it's the last opportunity to answer it within a kinship. The chat is always open. The question of the week channel is always open. So I'm wondering if you have a response to the question of the week and what that might be.
The last question that I saw was differentiating between evil and wrong. Is that what you're referring to, or did I?
Yeah. So the question, it is still the question of the week. It's going to change today, but right now it's still the question of the week. The question of the week is, whenever you have done wrong, were you being evil or were you being misguided?
Yeah. I mean, I'd just be echoing everything that you said. And it's funny because I was literally having dinner with my brother last night and we had this conversation. He, as you can imagine, was having a difficult time kind of wrapping his head around the fact that no one does wrong willingly.
Mm-hmm.
But if you really examine everything that you have done, that you look back and you're like, you know what, that was a mistake. Something in that moment of decision making made you feel like it's okay or justified the action. So, yeah, I absolutely think that you don't do wrong willingly, because that just goes against your nature. You do something that ultimately you believe, even if it's momentary, even if it's for a couple of seconds, that it benefits you, right? And just because you snap out of that state immediately right after doesn't undermine the reality of things. So I certainly believe that, again, you don't do wrong willingly, because that would make you evil. And I would extend that same line of thinking to the events that unfold around me as well. And you're hearing this from someone who, you know, you mentioned having rocks in your pockets, who unfortunately did kind of become resentful for believing the opposite of this. Like certain things would happen, I witness certain things and I get angry, right? I was actually mentioning to the others in the chats in the general channel the other day at the gym. This guy throws his empty water bottle in the sink of the water fountain. And my immediate response, well, I got frustrated, but then again, thanks to you know, all your teachings and all the work that I've done, I allowed myself to quickly return to a stable state. And just in a very friendly manner, I just mentioned to him that, hey, there are recycling bins nearby. So, yeah, sorry, I don't want to get off topic too much here, but absolutely, I believe that none of us do wrong willingly. And you have to think that way by yourself, so you're not so critical of your past mistakes. But also, this allows you to be more compassionate towards the wrongdoing of others around you.
Amazing. And I like hearing about how you applied it in your real practical life, right? Because that's what we're after. We're not just after trying to think differently people and argue with them and say, oh, you know what? Evil doesn't actually exist. It's supposed to have a real life impact. It's supposed to show up in experience. And if it doesn't, either we're just not able to perceive it yet, or it just has no value, period. And so that's why it's very much relevant that you said that. Because again, it brings you out of peace. This idea of evil, this belief in the concept of evil brings you out of peace, because once you believe in evil, evil is everywhere, all the time, at all times. And so you'll never have peace. People who believe in evil to the degree that they do and let it affect their minds have no peace. Because their peace now is in the control of others. Other people have to stop being evil for evil not to exist, and then so that then they can be at peace. And absolutely, that doesn't sit right with me. Anything where you say it's in the, my happiness, my peace is up to another, is in the hands of someone else, as soon as you say that, that doesn't sit right with me. So anything that indicates that, that might be the truth, or that a belief leads to that place, I immediately want to make double, triple sure that that is really the case. And evil is one of those things. And so it's so easy to see evil in others, and it's so difficult to see it in yourself. Why is that?
You have all the information.
Yeah, because and whenever we do wrong, that's why I phrase the question like that. Whenever you do wrong, are you being evil or are you being misguided? Whenever we do wrong, we see that we were being misguided. We see the information we lacked, and we see that we would never do it again. Yet when someone else makes the same mistake or any other mistake, we call it evil, because we assume that they were doing it on purpose. And again, awareness does not equal purpose. That someone, even if they are aware, and so many people are not even aware, by the way, that guy would not have thrown that bottle in the sink in front of you if he had known it was wrong. Because he would have hid it. He would have done it in secret, as so many people do wrong things in secret, right? They are aware, but they're still ignorant that that's wrong. So how can we say that we were just mistaken, ignorant, misguided, but we don't extend that to others? The same thing that is going on inside of us is going on inside of others. How do we not see that? So if we are misguided, other people are misguided, and we truly are misguided, it's right. You have never done anything in your life wrong that you wanted to do wrong, that you knew it was wrong, or that you knew it was wrong, but you couldn't help yourself to do it anyway. That's not willingness. That's not control. Like I said, that you're aware about it doesn't mean that you're willing. So even if you were doing something wrong and you were aware of it, it was because you were overcome by some desire. You couldn't stop a vice of yours. You couldn't stop an illusion. You were too weak. And we all know what weakness is like. We all know what making a mistake is like. We all know what falling prey to your desires or to your illusions or to your misconceptions is like. Why can't we extend that to others? And so this was the, by the way, thank you so much for everything you said. I'll move you back to the audience just so you're not constantly expecting to. Yeah. So I'll move you back to the audience. Thank you very much. That was so valuable. Everything you shared and said, thank you so much. And I do look forward to keep talking about this whenever you do have the time and you want to join again. So that was the idea behind this question of the week. See the misguidedness in yourself and know that the same thing is going on with others. There are no such thing as monsters under your bed or monsters in war or monsters in the cars that other people are driving. It's all the same spirit. It's all the same human nature. There's a lot of wrongdoing. Not one wrongdoing is excused. Not one wrongdoing is diminished when you look at the world in this way. It's explained. It is not diminished or excused. It is explained. And don't believe in illusions anymore. Don't believe in this idea of evil in the sense that people who do wrong know exactly what they're doing and they endorse it and they fully see through their own actions and they see the end and they have perfect information and they're super competent and they know exactly what they're doing, why they're doing, and their plan is working perfectly. It's never happened. Never happened. Just see what you see in yourself and others. And without taking up too much of your time, I want to share the new question of the week. So this is the question of the week going forward. Whenever you judge someone, follow the judgment and see where it goes home. And I want to explain that a little bit. Whenever we judge someone, we know exactly where our judgment is going. It's going to this person at this time due to this action, and it is this. We see a person throwing a water bottle instead of the recycling bin in a public area. And we know exactly when, we know exactly why, we know exactly to whom our judgment is directed towards. But where is it coming from? Where did it originate? What does it call home? Where does it go back to? What is the source of our judgment? And I'm not talking about judgment generally. Because we might just say, well, judgment comes from me. No, I know that. But look at a specific judgment, a specific instance in your life, and try to answer the question, where did that come from? Is this clear enough? Like, why did I just make this judgment? Don't just say, it comes from within me, it comes from my mind, or it comes from my past experiences. Literally pin down, where does this come from? If you're a very religious person and you see someone not going to church on Sunday and you judge them for it, where does that come from? Trace it back. Well, I think it's right to go to church on Sundays. Why? Where does that idea come from? Well, I've been taught that in my religion that's the right thing to do. It pleases God. I'm making this up entirely, by the way, just to give you a hypothetical example. So now you can say, this judgment comes from what I've learned in school, in my family, in my religion, in my workplace. I came up with this myself due to this experience, whatever it may be, whatever it may be. You make judgments all day long, all the time. You don't want to be doing it, but we all do it, right? Grab one of them in the next week, right? Until the next kinship. Grab one of them and follow it home. see exactly where it came from. Not only that it comes from you, not only that it comes from this area of your life, of your experience, but what specific belief is it tied to and where does that belief come from, etc., until you followed it home, until it stops moving, follow it. And I will write this question out a little better when I put it in the question of the week channel. I will make it more precise as much as I can, and I might even give an example. So leave that up to me and give me some time to do that. But for everyone who's here right now, I hope this explanation was enough. Whenever you make a judgment, follow that exact precise judgment back home. See exactly where it came from. And then hold on to that knowledge. Don't judge it. Don't say, oh, that's good, that's bad, that's terrible, whatever. Just remember it. Remember it so that we can talk about it. Okay, just remember it. Notice these things. Notice where your judgments come from, the specific judgments. And but again, please don't make the mistake of judging yourself because of your judgment. Don't make the mistake of seeing that your judgment comes obviously from some wrong belief and then judge yourself for still having that belief, even though you're working on yourself. And don't fall into any kind of despair of thinking, oh, but I can't get rid of it, I feel so helpless. Don't do any of it. All I would like you to try to do is to observe, follow it home without any judgment, without any value judgment of good or bad or anything like that. Just look where is it going back to when it comes back to you? Where does it come from? Just look at it, observe it, write down the details, the address that it went back to, and don't judge it one way or another. Just remember it, and then we'll talk about it.